Hello, welcome to Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm your volunteer reader in Flagstaff, Deborah McFadder, with excerpts from Yes Media, a nonprofit independent publisher of solutions journalism. Through rigorous reporting on the positive ways communities are responding to social problems and insightful commentary that sparks constructive discourse, Yes Media inspires people to build a more just, sustainable, and compassionate world. We begin today with the section Opinion. Murmurations, The Wisdom Behind Prison Walls by Gilda Shepherd, first published August 29, 2024. A graphic is at the beginning of this article. The colors are mostly grayish blue and turquoise, and a little bit of beige and pinkish colors at the bottom. Across the bottom of the drawing are lines that indicate a fence that at the top has barbed wire wrapped around it. In the background, we see lots of white birds. They surely could be doves, and they are flying to what might be the clouds, but instead of the clouds having cloud shapes, they are the shapes of large sunflowers done in turquoise and gray and blue, and the shape of a zinnia. A note from Adrienne Marie Brown. Gilda Shepherd directed a film called Since I've Been Down, in which Camonte Carter was a protagonist as a transformed man leading his community behind bars. The film lit up my abolitionist heart. These storytellers have so much to teach us. It was a hot summer day in 2007 when I wrapped filming for a documentary about women and children's organizing and leadership in a refugee camp in Ghana. As I was saying my goodbyes, a woman approached me and said, "You know, sis, the same AK-47s in child soldiers' hands in Liberia's civil war are in your children's hands in the United States. You need to do something about that." The comment stuck with me and ultimately shaped the subsequent decades of my life when I volunteered to teach sociology courses inside prisons in Washington State, then spent 12 years filming inside those same prisons and in the neighborhoods, homes, and communities from which those incarcerated people came. I became deeply concerned with how the culture of punishment impacts the lives of children. Our 2020 documentary, Since I've Been Down, is a love letter to those children. Our film invites viewers to take an in-depth look at incarceration in order to better understand the processes that led a person to prison, their resilience, and prisoners' ultimate role as models for all of us. Set in Tacoma, Washington, the film bears witness to an every-town, urban neighborhood's fight to stay alive in the face of racial profiling by police, gangs, drugs, and gun violence. The film brings to life statistics of racial and gender disparity in housing, education, employment, and incarceration, and shows viewers the real impact of gentrification through stories from community members impacted by it. Viewers get a window into the ways that incarcerated people are organizing to bring education, healing, and compassion to one another and those who have been harmed, both in and outside prison walls. In 1993, Washington state voters were the first to pass a three-strikes law, ostensibly designed to discourage repeat offenders by implementing increasingly severe sentences for each conviction, including mandatory minimum sentences for specific offenses. Washington is also one of 17 U.S. states that does not offer parole, including for life sentences, and is among the few states that incarcerates youth as young as age 12. It was also among the first cities to set up surveillance cameras in poor and black communities. This combination of policies, influenced by the frenzy of the war on drugs and perceptions of escalating crime and gang activity in the fear-mongering political climate of the late 1980s and early 1990s, led Tacoma voters to sacrifice their most valuable and vulnerable children, discarded as irredeemable super predators. This culture of punishment, combined with the city's lack of social services, disinvestments in early education, and increasing inequality in housing and employment, stained the Tacoma landscape and destined these children to live their lives out behind bars. Yet even when thrown into prison for punitive removal from society, these children, now adults, could not be silenced. Together they built a prisoner's community of healing, anchored in restorative and transformative justice that extended beyond prison walls. The film chronicles the impact of two prisoner-led groups that have been critical to growing efforts to dismantle the culture of oppression that permeates Tacoma and countless other cities nationwide. The Black Prisoners Caucus, BPC, established in Washington State prisons in 1972, and BPC Teach, Taking Education and Creating History, in 2013, offer blueprints for repair within the communities they once harmed. Two members of Teach describe the organization as a communal learning environment that's not physical, but mental, spiritual, and emotional. The experiences of BPC and BPC Teach members illuminate the essential roles of activism, compassion, love, and self-forgiveness in personal and community transformation. The culture of punishment that groups like BPC are working to dismantle is unfortunately a pervasive element of our shared reality in America today, especially in these times of legislated violence and fear of difference. Who better to show us the triumphs of the human spirit than those caught behind bars for life? The film introduces us to Camonte Carter, who grew up in Tacoma. He was convicted in 1998 at age 18 of aggravated murder connected to a drive-by shooting. He was sentenced to 777 years without the possibility of parole. Carter became not only our protagonist, but the spine of our film. His story embodies the triumph of the human spirit. Even when faced with social forces that attempted to define the margins as a place of deprivation, never of possibility. In 2021, the Washington Supreme Court ruled that mandatory minimum sentences are unconstitutional for 18, 19, and 20-year-olds, pointing to a rethinking of the culpability and punishment for young people as science has revealed more about their developing brains, according to the Seattle Times. This ruling opened the door for Carter's July 2022 resentencing, when a judge determined that Carter, having served 25 years in prison, must be released. He now serves as a community outreach specialist with the Washington State Office of Public Defense and continues to work with BPC Community Group and other formerly incarcerated peers and youth in schools, education, health care, prisons, and juvenile facilities. Carter's goals are reflected in the film as we see him, then and now, deeply committed to policy change, youth activism, and support for prisoner-initiated programs. Carter's leadership was essential to the 2013 creation of BPC's Teach program, where incarcerated people teach each other ways that they can create history. Teach brings together incarcerated people across race, ethnicity, and gang lines, and provides them tools to question oppression and the violent behavior that oppression perpetuates among and between people. While filming, I was able to bear witness to a Teach classroom where a prisoner wearing swastika tattoos spoke with a Black man and a man from Central America about the need for respect. The men questioned their own ideologies and practices and how they each faced similar oppression despite their differences. We traveled this journey with them through candid conversations of scenes fired in a kiln of cinema verite and cinematically rendered through crump dancing and masquerade as we bear witness to the nuances of reflective voice, trauma, contemplative silence, fear, and unbinding love. Our humanity is nudged and at times ambushed while watching the film because the men and women who seem to have an answer to our societal problems have been convicted of violent crimes. The film does not question their innocence or guilt, but rather our own preconceptions about humanity and the tensions between compassion, punishment, crime, and justice. Distinct black women's voices provide the tenderness, rhythm, and urgency of this compelling story. Since I've Been Down is dedicated to broadening conversations across significant differences to inspire all of us to become visionary, liberatory thinkers. Our film bears witness to the triumph of the human spirit, allowing us to take a long look at our humanity. As Carter reminds us, we can never be someone different, but we can be a better version of who we are. To request a screening of Since I've Been Down, reach out to the filmmaker at info@sinceibeendown.com. A little about the author. Gilda Shepherd is an award-winning filmmaker who has screened her documentaries throughout the United States and internationally in Ghana, South Africa, at the Festival Afrique Cannes Film Festival, at the International Black Film Festival in Berlin, and in Canada and British Columbia. Shepherd is a 2017 Hedgebrook Fellow for Documentary Film, a 2019 recipient of an Artist Trust Fellowship, and 2023 Best Director for Documentary at the New York Independent Film Festival. She lives in Washington State and speaks English. Find out more about her at gildashepherd.com. You are tuned to Sun Sounds of Arizona, listening to excerpts from Yes Media. Remember, if you miss a broadcast, you can always find it on demand at sunsounds.org. Broadcast info and audio on demand. We move into a section of the media that's entitled News. This article is The Rights of Nature Prevail Again in Ecuador by Peter Jung, first published September 11, 2024. A man is in a photograph at the beginning of this article. Behind him is dark green jungle. He has dark, straight hair and a dark goatee and mustache. His eyebrows are bushy. His eyes are brown. He's looking right at us at the camera. We can tell by what's on his shoulder that he's carrying a backpack. His name is Jose Martin Avando. Jose Martin Avando suddenly halts in his tracks and crouches down along the steep forest path, shrouded in mist, pulling out a magnifying glass from his small backpack to inspect a clump of deep green moss. Among the greenery, he has spotted an orchid, Dracula Morleyi, blotted in black with a flash of white at the center. It's barely bigger than a fingernail. This place is full of so much biodiversity, he grins. Scientists don't even know about most of it. Avando is a guide at Los Cedros Protective Forest, a 4,800 hectare, which is the same as 11,860-acre, reserve of cloud forest in the northwest Ecuadorian Andes, one of the world's most biodiverse areas. Now there's another color photograph that's up close to a very small flower or blossom that is brightly striped in red and what appears to be almost silver. At the top of it, there are some little shapes like petals that are an orangey color with a deep red center. And at the bottom, it has a shape that looks like the capsule of a pill that you would take, and it's yellow and hot pink colored. This tropical haven, home to a wealth of wildlife, including the critically endangered black and chestnut eagle and brown-headed spider monkey, jaguars, endemic frogs, more than 300 species of birds, 600 kinds of moths, and 200 varieties of orchids, is at the forefront of a global movement to recognize the legal rights of the natural world. The movement is rooted in the common indigenous belief that nature, from the Andean mountains to Amazonian rivers, right down to a single soldier ant, is a system to which human beings belong and with which they must harmoniously exist. The legal theory argues that these ecosystems and species have intrinsic rights that should be protected in the same way as those of humans. The idea that rocks, rivers, and animals are alive and so should be granted a legal status is a core aspect of indigenous worldviews, says Cesar Rodriguez Garavito, professor of clinical law and director of NYU School of Law's More Than Humans Rights Project, an initiative attempting to further non-human rights and the larger web of life. Indigenous peoples have turned that belief into practices of reciprocity with nature through ceremonies, use of medicinal plants, and more. The planet faces a human-led sixth mass extinction that has already wiped out entire species and risks destroying the whole ecosystem. This destruction would accelerate under authoritarian regimes and right-wing agendas around the globe, including Project 2025 in the United States. Los Cedros is the world's leading example of how non-anthropocentric laws can be used to effectively defend the planet. By putting ourselves, we humans, outside of nature, we're hurting ourselves, says Biddy Roy, an ecologist at the University of Oregon who first visited Los Cedros in 1998 and has since returned many times. We live within the system of nature. We rely on it, and it's part of us. The rights of nature recognizes this in a way that old laws have not. So-called rights of nature arguments, a novel conservation strategy dating back to the 1990s, have been lodged in 397 cases across 34 countries and even the United Nations, according to the Eco Jurisprudence Monitor. These cases have been brought from Bolivia to Brazil to Uganda, as well as Canada, Mexico, and the U.S. Some cases have broadly recognized the rights of rivers, watersheds, mountains, and even the entirety of Mother Earth, whereas others have focused on species like seals in the North Sea, sea turtles in Panama, or a specific animal such as Tommy the chimpanzee, who was living in a cage in New York. In one particularly creative case this year, campaigners succeeded in getting music streaming platforms to allow nature to be credited for sounds used in songs. In Ecuador, the groundwork was set in 2008 when, thanks to lobbying from indigenous groups, the country adopted a new constitution that included the rights of Pachamama, in essence stating that Mother Nature has the same rights as people. Now there is a photograph of Joseph Deku, an American environmentalist. He purchased the land on which Los Cedros sits in 1988 and managed a scientific station in the reserve until his death in May 2024. The gentleman who's pictured has long white hair that's pulled back in a ponytail and long mutton chops along with a mustache, wireframe glasses. He's wearing a black t-shirt and blue jeans and brown laced-up shoes. He's also wearing a white vest with lots of pockets in it and carrying a walking stick. On his arm is a wristwatch, and he has rings on several of his fingers. All around him are different kinds of ferns and trees. But Los Cedros' story began much earlier. Today, the reserve is owned by the state, but in 1988, the land was purchased by Joseph Deku, an American environmentalist who managed a scientific station at the heart of the reserve until his death in May 2024. Bit by bit, with the help of friends and nonprofits, including Friends of the Earth, Sweden, and Australia's Rainforest Information Center, Deku bought land in the area in order to preserve it. For many years, he lived in a shack deep in the forest. "I fell in love with the unique beauty of this place," said Deku during a visit to the monitoring station in Los Cedros shortly before his death following a years-long battle with cancer. I immediately knew that I wanted to dedicate my life to this forest, and that's what I've done. Deku worked with indigenous communities in the surrounding Mandariacos Valley to build local support for the effort, resulting in Los Cedros securing state conservation status in 1994. People stopped shooting all the monkeys, he added. They appreciated the reserve and its value and how it protects the watershed. Now there's another color photograph taken from the air over this area, this rainforest area, and we are looking down through rather thin clouds towards the forest, but we can tell that it's also got mountainous area. As a result, Los Cedros, which ranges from 3,000 to 9,000 feet in altitude and is crossed by four rivers, thrived in contrast to the mass deforestation suffered by the surrounding highly endangered Andean cloud forests. Under an open-door policy aimed at raising the profile of the reserve, scientists came from across the world to study its wealth of biodiversity, with more than 140 scientific papers now published. I could spend time studying a single square meter of Los Cedros and still not understand everything there, Roy says. Western Ecuador is head and shoulders above the rest of the world in terms of amphibian, bird, and plant biodiversity. However, conservation efforts hit a major stumbling block in 2017 when the government granted the state-owned mining company Enami EP rights to mining concessions for copper and gold in more than two-thirds of Los Cedros landmass. This is where the rights of nature legislation came into play. Before extraction could begin, a legal challenge was tabled at the provincial court by the local government of Cotacachi, a region home to 43 indigenous communities. After an appeal, the case was then taken to Ecuador's constitutional court. The claimants argued that if mining was to proceed in Los Cedros, it would violate the forest's constitutional rights, and they demanded the protection of its right to exist, survive, and regenerate. After a years-long battle, in December 2021, judges at the Constitutional Court finally annulled the concession that had been granted to the mining company, in effect turning a theoretical constitutional text into a tangible, real-world policy. The unprecedented verdict was one of the first times that any court in the world had ever recognized the rights of non-human organisms, and the judges went as far as to state that the law not only applied to Los Cedros and to other protected areas, but under the terms of the Constitution, to any kind of nature within the country of Ecuador. There was no case before this. There was no precedent, added Deku. It was a case of science winning over extractive industries. In Los Cedros, the miners were forced to remove their machinery immediately, and the court banned all future mining and other extractive activities. Now, 24 hours a day, the reserve thrums with activity from the early morning roars of howler monkeys among the dense canopy to the afternoon squawks of toucans and the buzzes of nocturnal bats swooping after the many critters that fill the night sky. It is a clear and great pleasure to observe the greatness of the animal kingdom here every day, says Obando, as he watches a pair of yellow-beaked toucans in the distance. Life is calmer here now. The wildlife is more at ease. Follow-up monitoring has also confirmed the early impact of the ruling. As part of a report published by the More Than Human Rights Project in June 2024, Rodriguez Garavito visited Los Cedros twice and found that mining equipment and staff had been removed from the reserve, which remained a sanctuary for biodiversity, thanks to the ruling. The report concluded that the enforcement of the rights of nature and rulings like Los Cedros can be effective tools to protect endangered ecosystems. I was positively surprised, Rodrigo Scaravito says, especially because Los Cedros is in the midst of the region with many active mining projects. It should not be taken for granted that these rulings will be properly implemented. Proponents argue that the successful use of those rights to defend an ecosystem like Los Cedros has set a powerful precedent, and it is already influencing rulings in Ecuador and beyond. In July, the indigenous Kitukara people won a case claiming pollution violated the rights of the Machangara River, which runs through Ecuador's capital, Quito. In March, Peru recognized the rights of the Marañón River to be free of pollution after a lawsuit was brought by the Cucuma Indigenous Women's Organization against the oil company Petroperú. A recent claim relating to Ecuador's Fierro Urco wetlands even referenced the Los Cedros precedent in court filings. It's a phenomenon that's catching fire, and it's spreading very rapidly around the world, Rodriguez Garavito says. Because the Los Cedros case is a sophisticated and detailed judicial decision, it's being referenced by other courts. Nicola Peel, an environmentalist who first visited Los Cedros in 1999 and testified during the constitutional court case, argues that the ruling marks a turning point in global conversation. I absolutely believe that the time has come for the rights of nature, she says. This feels like the natural progression for a new era. However, plenty of concerns remain over the long-term success of the ruling in Los Cedros and rights of nature cases more generally, in the face of powerful extractive industries and limited resources to monitor and enforce legal protections. The courts move on to new cases, Rodriguez Garavito says. But the argument behind my study is that researchers, policymakers, and advocates must continue paying attention to implementation. We need to follow what happens after. The Ganges River, for example, which is considered sacred by more than a billion Indians, was recognized by the highest court in the Indian state of Uttarakhand, which is home to part of the river, as a living entity in 2017. But sewage and industrial waste has continued to pollute that river since, and it mostly remains undrinkable. Rodrigo Scaravito's findings also highlighted other threats to Los Cedros, mining activities in nearby areas that risk a spillover effect, a growing problem with organized crime in Ecuador that could hinder efforts, grossly insufficient resources for park rangers, and the passing of Deku, who led the movement. That's where we'll stop for today. You have been tuned to Sun Sounds of Arizona, listening to excerpts from Yes Media. I'm your volunteer reader, Deborah McFadder from Flagstaff. Thanks a lot for listening.